And now, from the world's leading maritime and offshore news website, gcaptain.com, comes the talk show for maritime professionals and enthusiasts, bringing you the latest news, discussion, and interviews with the industry's movers and shakers. This is GCaptain Radio with your hosts, Jeff Eccles and Captain John Conrad.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of GCaptain Radio. My name is Jeff Eccles and in the studio with me is John Conrad. Welcome, John. How are you today?
Doing good, Jeff.
Excellent. This broadcast is for the week of July 8th, 2013. Listeners, this is the place we bring you the latest news and happenings in the maritime and offshore industry. Today we'll be talking about some interesting things. Bananas, which hold some lore, and what would be the word I'm looking for? We're a superstitious bunch, aren't we, out there at sea? So there are some superstitions regarding bananas. So we're going to talk about some of the dangers of transporting bananas. We're also going to do a little bit of follow-up with the Comfort, the ship that broke in two, talk about some regulations. And we didn't have time to talk last week about the IMO. Captain John had some definite thoughts on the IMO, so we'll follow up on that as well. But first off, John, happy post-4th of July. Did you have a good 4th of July?
I had a great 4th of July. Actually, some of the forum members I was posting looking for a new cooler. And some of the offshore fishermen gave me some really good ideas. There's some really hardcore coolers out there. And a few other of the forum members are saying, please don't post about the 4th us being on the ship. But considering that I've missed 10, I think it's 10 4th of Julys in my career, I said I'm going to enjoy this one without regret or guilt.
And we're doing this broadcast in California. I understand you were out on the bay on your sailboat for this 4th of July.
Yes, we were, and we were only about 150 feet from the fireworks barge. I didn't know that you could safely go that close, but Harbor Patrol assured me it was okay, and it was front row seats.
Very nice. So, 4th of July here in Morro Bay, California. We put our barge out in the bay, launched those fireworks. The fog was down to probably about a 500 or 600-foot ceiling, so some of them put out a nice glow, but the lower ones were a nice marking of the celebration of the birthday of the United States of America. So happy post-4th of July, everybody. Well, John, let's get right into it. Let's talk about this banana situation. Growing up in Southern California, I did a lot of diving, free diving off the Channel Islands. And I remember one time I brought some bananas in my duffel bag out on a cattle boat, on a party boat. And somebody saw the bananas in my duffel bag and made me throw them immediately overboard. And they told me, bananas are bad luck on a boat. I didn't realize that bananas were bad luck on a boat, and I had carried them, frankly, in my duffel bag for years up to that point. Nobody had ever really noticed, but since then, I've adhered to the superstition of not carrying bananas on board dive boats, and it seems to make everybody happy. But there is a problem on transporting bananas in the cargo holds of these large transport ships. So what's going on there?
Yeah, I really question that superstition because bananas is one of the largest cargoes in the maritime trade. Maersk recently came out with a report saying that bananas and fruit exports were one of their most profitable cargoes because not only are they take up a large volume of space, but they have to be put in reefer containers and in some of the banana ships loaded directly in the holds. And they have to be kept at a cool temperature. So there are literally thousands of ships carrying bananas at this point, and most of those ships arrive safely. But the real danger here is the new technology or new methods of keeping these bananas from spoiling.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first bananas were transported. There was on a sailing ship, and they had good weather. They were coming from Central America up to, I believe, Boston. And they could only transport these bananas during good weather because they spoil so quickly. And then when steamships came and they were able to transport these faster, and there was a lot of some of the first great American fleets were built around bananas. Then refrigeration came in. They figured out ways to lower the temperature in the holds, and they could transport bananas in greater distances. But now what they're doing is they're injecting nitrogen into these holds. And by displacing the oxygen with nitrogen, they're able to extend the shelf life of these bananas. And when they arrive at their destination, they're fresher, and they can be left on the supermarket shelves longer.
Now, that makes sense to me. Two things come to my mind. One is there is an argon gas now. I don't know if you're a wine drinker, but I enjoy a bottle of wine on the every now and then. And on the Central Coast, we grow lots of wine. And the newest way of preserving an opened wine bottle for several days is by purchasing a can of this argon gas, doing the same thing, displacing the oxygen on top of the wine. The argon is heavier than the oxygen, and it puts a layer of this gas right on top of the wine, and therefore the wine doesn't oxidize, and it preserves the wine. So that makes sense. The other thing that's interesting, John, though, is I know that bananas, and maybe we're getting outside of our realm here because neither one of us are botanists or chemists, but I know that bananas emit this gas themselves that, if left in a confined area, will rapidly increase the pace of the ripening process. You know, there's that old trick, if you want avocados or plums or really any other fruit to ripen quickly, you put it in a drawer or a bag with a banana, and it will dramatically increase the ripening rate of that other fruit. So I'm wondering, too, if the nitrogen that they put in to displace the oxygen has any effect on the bananas emitting whatever gas the bananas emit as well. So we'll just have to speculate and wonder at this point, unless we've got any chemists out there that can fill us in. Of course, there's an obvious question here, or potential problem, and I think this is where this story is leading us. If there's no oxygen down in those holds, then it's going to be an unsafe environment for anything that needs to aspirate, anything that needs to breathe. So certainly probably would get rid of any rats that are down there. But as a crew member, I don't think I'd want to be down there either.
No, and nerding a tank, it really comes from the tanker industry, and they found that displacing the oxygen in a tanker greatly improves safety because a spark will not catch the tanker on fire. And for many years, they scrubbed the gas, so they took the emissions from the diesel engine on board the ship, and they scrubbed out the heat and some of the caustic material, the sulfur in those emissions, and they pumped them right into the oil tank. And that inerted the tanks and prevented explosions. Then they realized that by inerting the ballast tanks, the segregated ballast tanks, tanks that only carry water, you could prevent rust and corrosion. So a lot of tankers now, they inert, or at least the good ones, inert the ballast tanks and the double hull to prevent corrosions. But when they started inerting the segregated ballast tanks, prior to that, all the inertia, it smelled the stack gas, you know, the exhaust from this engine. But when they put it into segregated ballast, they really wanted to take out all the last bits of corrosive material. So they started going with double scrubbers. And they'd scrub the gas once and then scrub it again. And it would remove so much of the sulfur that you couldn't smell. So it used to be when you opened up a tank that was inerted, you could smell the inert gas inside. Right.
Which would give you some warning that there's basically a lack of oxygen in there. The same concept with natural gas. They put an odor in there so that you know that it's there.
Exactly. Yeah. With some of this technology, they're getting rid of the sulfur in the gas so well that you can't smell it.
Right.
And with this banana technology, they're not using stack gas. They're using nitrogen that they purchase in bottles and putting into these holds. So there's absolutely no smell. So the lesson right here is that crew members really have to treat all these spaces and all spaces that you don't go into very often as possibly toxic or at least not having the oxygen needed to support life.
Now, have there been, to your knowledge, have there been some reports of any deaths or injuries due to this?
There are frequent deaths as far as confined space entry. The other one that's most dangerous is just normal rusting. So a chain locker is one of the most dangerous places on ship. So for rust, you need oxygen, but you also need salt and water. And where does that come in? The chain from the anchor comes up, and those elements mix in the chain locker, and it creates this hyper rust. Some of the magazines have called it super rust. There's nothing super about it. It's just regular rust that has been accelerated by more salt, more water, more oxygen.
An optimal environment for the rust to occur.
Yeah. And this super rust eats a lot of oxygen. So chain lockers are notorious for having low oxygen levels because as that rust forms, the oxygen goes down and mariners die if they don't ventilate properly.
Interesting. So, and that leads me to my question for you. What can we do other than ventilation? Obviously, it seems that ventilation would be a first course of action to alleviate the situation. Are there any other things that can be done that you're aware of?
Yes, you have to do proper testing techniques. So there are oxygen analyzers. Every ship has them. And those have to be used prior to entering the confined space. It's basically a tube that you roll down into the space and it sucks up the oxygen. But also ventilation is not as simple as you think. I suggest everyone who does any confined space entry go to the Navy website. The Navy has lots of free manuals for damage control and everything to scuba diving and handling explosives. But one of their best is their advice on confined space entry. And they really show you how you set up those blowers and making sure that you get that fresh air into the corners of the tank is pretty tricky. And if you don't know how to do it properly, you're going to miss pockets of these gas that can be potentially lethal. The thing about this bananas, though, is one, that it's, you can't smell it. You can't smell the lack of oxygen.
Right.
And number two is a lot of these are in spaces that aren't normally classified as confined spaces. So that's where the real danger is. And right. The answer is to treat all spaces as potentially confined.
Interesting. And it's something that's easy to forget about as you're going around to different areas and spaces on a ship. Sometimes you might just not actually realize that you're in a potentially dangerous confined environment and that ventilation is so important. The website that you mentioned, the Naval website, do you know the actual address? How do we get to that?
We'll have a link to it on the show notes and send you right to their document.
Excellent. Very good. I actually haven't checked that out, and I'm looking forward to checking out that website. Anything else, John, with regard to the banana boats and the transports of bananas? And really, more interesting than I actually thought it would be in terms of the analysis of confined spaces on boats, because it seems to be a sort of a sleeping danger, but is on every boat, really, every ship.
Well, I've read the history of banana and banana transport, and one of the most interesting things I found is, where do you keep your bananas, Jeff?
I generally keep my bananas up on the counter there.
And so does 99% of America. But the proper place to put bananas is in your fridge. It was one of the biggest marketing ploys in the history of the country. This banana grower, he realized that if people left them on the counter and they ripen quicker, they wouldn't last as long and people had to buy more bananas.
Right.
So a little tip for the radio listeners is keep your bananas in the fridge. That's where we keep them on ships. That's where they belong.
Or better yet, you know, you could do the staggered thing. You buy a bunch of bananas, half of them in the fridge, half of them on the counter.
And exactly.
You've got perfectly ripened bananas in a series of time there. Well, and that also, you know, they sell these little hooks. Have you ever seen those little banana hooks?
No.
You set them on the counter. I've never bought one. I thought they were kind of silly, but it's basically an extended hook that elevates the bananas up off of the counter. So it's a hook that goes up 12 or 14 inches. I never really saw the need for that. So I think another one of those famous marketing ploys.
And I'm interested in more of these superstitions. Maybe we'll have a podcast where we debunk some of these myths.
That's right. That would be, and there's plenty of them. That would be an interesting show. There's plenty of them that we could choose from. All right, so let's move on. We did talk last week about the Comfort, the transport vessel that broke in half and right at the watertight bulkheads and was floating. We had the forward portion of the ship floating and the aft portion of the ship floating as well. The forward portion wound up sinking.
Was the aft.
It was the aft. The aft section wound up sinking, and they were towing the forward section in for salvage, and it seems like this ship has a bad omen with it. The tug lines apparently broke.
Correct.
And so they had a tough time with that, but have they reconnected it? What's the status?
They have reconnected it. We don't have the latest status. Apparently, it hasn't reached port yet. But the thing about the salvage op is where operations is where do you connect these tow lines? And you have to get somebody up on the damaged vessel to connect the tow lines. And there isn't really opportunity to do proper welding and to test the tow connections. So we don't know if the tow cable parted or if it was, you know, an area wherever they fixed the tow cable that wasn't strong enough. But it's a very dangerous operation that bow section will not be safe until it is in port tied up to the dock.
Mm-hmm. And this leads also to the issue of regulations. We wanted to follow up this week as well with the IMO, the International Maritime Organization.
Correct.
And talk about that. You had some distinct thoughts on that as far as their efficacy, how effective they are, and the regulations that they have in place that they do or don't enforce. So what are your thoughts with regard to the regulations with the IMO? How bring this all together for us, John?
Well, we talked a little bit about last week how the hot topic is container weights. The containers are not being weighed prior to being loaded on the vessel, and this can lead to stability issues. But the bigger issue here is the strength of the ship. It doesn't matter what's in those containers. The ship, 5-year-old ship, is a new ship. Why was it not able to take the stresses? There weren't significant, there was heavy weather, but not significant seas. There was nothing unusual about this. The ship broke in half. And, you know, there are a lot of questions that come in. One of them is shipyards. You know, when you buy a warranty on the car, everyone complains how you American car warranties are only, you know, what are they, a few years, mm-hmm. 3 years and 30,000 miles.
Well, right.
A ship warranty is only 1 year. That's all the shipyards give, typically.
No kidding. Wow. That's surprising to hear.
It is surprising to hear. And this ship is only 5 years, so 4 years past its warranty. And when you build something this large, this expensive, and the shipyards are only required that it survives for a year and then be financially responsible for the vessel. But if you look at all of the investigation reports, the shipyards are never brought into the investigation process. You never see a shipyard representative at the trials. You know,
right.
It's always the captain, the chief engineer, and a company representative.
Right. Good point.
And where are the shipyards and where are the classification societies are usually at the trials? But this all falls under the umbrella of the IMO. So the ship owner has to make a contract with the shipyards. Now, if the shipyards all together only have a 1 year warranty, who is responsible for making sure that their product is really safe? And it's the classification society. But the shipyards contract the class societies.
Right.
So they're paying the class society bills. So there is no third party that is, what's the word I'm looking for?
Independent.
Completely independent.
Sure. Completely independent,
overseeing this.
There's a potential conflict of interest, obviously, between the shipbuilders and those that they pay, those that are doing the certification.
Correct. And the person, the organization that is supposed to be independent is the IMO. Now, the IMO up till 1989 was called the Intergovernment Maritime Consultative Organization.
That sounds bureaucratic just by the name of it.
It sounds bureaucratic, and I mention that old name because that gives you an insight to the founding of this organization. They were formed in 1942, I believe, 48, sorry, right after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have their first meeting to 1956. But so they had a little bit of a late start.
Yeah, it's a bit of a slow start.
The thing about the IMO, though, is it comprises seats. So you every kind of maritime country has a seat on the IMO, but the number of seats, it's like the U.S. House of Representatives, is based on how many ships that flag state has in their organization.
Okay, so seats are apportioned by the number of flags that particular country flies.
Correct,
okay.
And who has the largest number of flags? It's Panama, Liberia,
sure.
Marshall Islands.
Sure.
All of the flags of convenience.
The flags of convenience, yes.
Now, ships that are required to fly the American flag, they're required by regulations. The Jones Act makes them. And the U.S. Coast Guard, because of that, is really, their flag is independent, as you say. They're looking after everyone's best interest.
Right.
But if the shipyards and the ship owners don't like the regulations the flag state is pushing to the IMO, they're going to change flags.
Sure.
So there's an impetus for the flag states to really serve their owner's best interest.
Yeah.
Now, they have two, their best interest is supposed to be in the owner's camp. But often the flag is decided by the shipyard. The shipyard says, we're going to base it off of these regulations. And the flag will actually be written in the shipyard contract.
Really? Wow.
So the shipyards have a lot of sway in deciding on new builds. The owner can always change it, but it's expensive and difficult to change it right after the shipyard gives it to you.
Right.
So the shipyards have this enormous sway in deciding where these new builds are going to be flagged.
Yep.
And the flag state with the largest number of vessels has the biggest sway at the IMO.
Yeah.
So we think that this organization is independent. It's a branch of the United Nations, after all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really an organization that's mostly controlled by the flags of convenience, which are in turn controlled by the owners and the shipyards, who have the mariner's best interest in mind, supposedly. And I don't want to... Most of the ship owners are wonderful, fantastic, especially the ones building. And the shipyards are doing a really great job now. I was just at a shipyard in Korea, and some amazing technology and really good building practices. But the fact still remains that financially, if a ship is lost at sea, that ship is insured. And the shipyards aren't responsible because it's after warranty. So
right.
Who is responsible for that loss of life, loss of containers? There's very little financial responsibility involved and no independent oversight.
Right. Wow. Boy, that is an interesting setup. And as you mentioned, it all comes down at the end of the day to the liability. And further than that, the financial liability. And the way the system is set up right now, the shipbuilders are basically off the hook completely after a year's period of time, after that warranty period. And then furthermore, the IMO consists of those nations of the flags of convenience. So it's what would you suggest as far as a change? Do you have any thoughts on how we could improve the system? It seems to me, just a thought off the top of my head, as far as the apportionment of the seats on the IMO, that it goes to a more equitable split, or maybe bicameral. Maybe we don't want to get too bureaucratic here, but of course the U.S. system in Congress is based on one on population and then the other just on a straight numerical value, the Senate. But it seems like something should be done there. Are you aware, John, of any impetus, any movement to change this, or is this just status quo right now and looks like it might be that bureaucratic status quo for the foreseeable future?
For many reasons, some of these reasons are good reasons, and some of them are purely financial and mm-hmm. profit-based. But for many reasons, the maritime industry as a whole is really stacked against change.
Mm-hmm.
Change is very difficult, and there is a lot of momentum and a lot of effort that's put into maintaining the status quo. Now, the one thing that is changing is the port states. So we find it very difficult to regulate ships in general, especially ships from devious owners and kind of the lower level ships. But they're starting to get regulated by the port states. By port saying, this ship is not coming into our waters unless it's a good quality ship that has been inspected and is undergoing standards. So the Coast Guard and the Europeans under the Paris MOU, which is an organization of European port states, and there's an Asian organization of port states. These port states are sending inspectors on board the vessels and saying, if this vessel doesn't meet our standards, we can arrest the vessel, we can prevent all the other vessels of that company or that flag from coming into our port. So this is the most promising development in recent years. This port states taking control of and denying vessels that are of substandard design. But the port states still, because it's based on the number of flags, the Coast Guard, the United States, of Great Britain, of France, they don't have much sway in the IMO. So maybe that is one suggestion where we have a bicameral. Maybe IMO has to have another section that is represented by the port states. So
mm-hmm.
the owners are on one side of the IMO with the flag states and the port states are on the other side of the IMO. I don't know, but the question is, how do we do this without making it more of a bureaucratic
right.
mess?
Right.
And, you know, whenever we have these casualties, the IMO solution is always more regulations.
Yeah.
Which translates to more paperwork for crews that are already overworked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another real problem with the IMO. And the last problem with the IMO, and this is maybe just one of my pet peeves, but I don't think so, is most of the committees are run by the classification societies because they have the expertise within the shipping industry.
Yeah.
But these guys are technical guys. They're engineers, naval architects. They don't know how to write, Jeff. They write like naval architects and engineers. They don't write simply and without fluff. They always put in their coefficients and their graphs and descriptions. And engineers are usually in engineering because they're not very good at English. That's their specialty,
right,
is mathematics. So
right,
we need just some people to simplify these regulations and make them easy to read and with as little nonsense as possible. And that's part of the reason the IMO doesn't change, because all of these procedures and in the IMO are so complicated and diluted that no one really understands how to change the IMO.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to look at simplicity and making the regulations as sparse and simple to read as possible.
Sounds like another bureaucratic mess, a mire of bureaucracy. So not an uncommon problem, and rarer is the solution. One thing that I think would work, I don't know how it would be enacted, but something that could help the situation, because in my mind, with the finance and economics background, I always follow the buck. I always follow the dollar.
Yes.
And in this instance, with the shipbuilders only having 365 days of financial liability, something that would seem to make sense to me right off the bat would be to extend that out. Of course, it's just like our car warranties. If you get a three-year car warranty, your car breaks down 3 years and 2 days after you purchased it, right? But the longer the warranty, the better. So
how much of a power do you have as a consumer to extend that warranty?
And that's the thing.
Very little. Ship owners have very little with the shipyards because it's industry standard.
Right. And you would, there are probably just a handful of shipbuilders that are able to control that market. And in a free market, the way economics is supposed to work, one shipbuilder would come up front and offer, let's say, a 36-month, a three-year warranty on their boats, and then the consumers, everybody, all the carrier lines would go to that shipbuilder, and they would have a competitive advantage, that shipbuilder would, because they're offering a better widget than the other shipbuilders. That's the way it's supposed to work. But of course, this is a smaller industry, almost a, not a monopoly, but almost a, what is it, oligopoly, where it's just a few builders that probably control a majority of the industry. So it's harder to get that real free competition to flow in this situation.
Yes, and 3 years isn't enough. You know, you really need a warranty that brings you past your first dry docking special survey, 5 years. That's what we need to start with, a five-year warranty that brings you through that dry docking. And that would also encourage owners to really do that dry docking special survey under the five-year limit.
Right.
Do it a little bit early and make sure everything is done right.
Which was one of the tragedies of the MOL Comfort. They were due in a matter of months, weren't they, for their five-year inspection, and the ship broke in half shortly before their 5 years.
Yes, and Class & K just came out with a statement that the ship did do its special survey in May, but was that a full dry docking? There were no details launched by the Classification Society saying what that special survey consisted of. So it's a big question.
All right. Well, good. We finally had a chance to talk about the IMO and get some of your beliefs out there. We're going to wrap up our show this week in a few moments, John. Any other thoughts with regard to the IMO?
I think one takeaway here is that more of these players, the IMO and the shipbuilders particularly, should be brought in these casualty investigations. So when we have hearings for the Deepwater Horizon down in New Orleans, where was DSME shipyards? And, you know, I frequently go to the shipyards. These comments may get me barred from ever visiting a shipyard again. But I think that they have some of the best engineers in the world and the best minds. They should be called to the trials, and they should be part of the casualty investigation.
Makes a lot of sense.
And that's something the Coast Guard could do overnight. Next casualty, they can subpoena the shipyards. And this is a change that can happen quickly.
All right, Congress people. Coast Guard, we hope you're listening. So that sums it up for this week. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next week to keep up with what's going on in the maritime and offshore industry. On behalf of John Conrad and myself, Jeff Eccles, we look forward to speaking with you again next week. Enjoy your summer, Be well and be safe.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest in maritime and offshore news. G-Captain Radio is a production of GCaptain.com and is recorded weekly in Morro Bay, California. For more information or to be a guest on the show, visit GCaptain.com.